Welcome to the Cosmoses Podcast. I'm Justin Moses, coming to you today from chilly Nashville. Today's Tuesday, January the 19th, the very day the podcast will come out. Seems even chillier, actually, since I just got back a couple of days ago from Tampa, Florida. Went down there and played a show at Skipper's Smokehouse with Dre and the Collective. I think that was a good time for all involved. Sierra and I both were down there and had a good visit with her management. They're based out of Tampa. And it was, in fact, so warm on Saturday that we had a little time at the beach. It was like 78 degrees. Couldn't have asked for a better day. Anyhow, this is episode 12 of the show, and the interview today is part two with John Weisberger. We'll have that in just a few minutes. I have some things on my mind to share today before we get to the interview. First of all, I've had some time off lately with the holidays and just getting rolling into the new year. And with that, I've done a lot of rearranging and reorganizing here at the old headquarters. So, actually coming to you today from the newly redesigned podcast studio here. And of course, now we're in tax season, and the reorganization kind of ties in with that. Just getting everything together, getting ready to do the old taxes. Wanted to hit on a couple of news items from the past couple of weeks in bluegrass. Just had some band changes, band movements, which tends to happen around this time of year a lot of times. Luke Dotson has left Mountain Faith. He's been with the band for a while. And they are just moving David Meyer over to guitar to fill his slot. Ironically, with the guest this week being John Weisberger of Chris Jones and the Night Drivers band, we talked about, actually, in this episode, the stability of that band, how long they've been together for like 12 years with the same lineup. But Ned Lubarecki announced this past week that he's leaving Chris Jones and the Night Drivers and will be joining Becky Boyler's new band that she's forming. I'll have more on that in just a second. And last but certainly not least, Ben Eldridge is retiring from the Seldom Scene after 44 plus years with the band. Now, the Seldom Scene is a legendary band, and we talked about them a little bit in a couple episodes back with Peter Cooper, who was very influenced by the Seldom Scene. I cannot really honestly cite Ben Eldridge as a big influence on my playing, but I've really grown to appreciate his playing more and more through the years, and it's sad to see him leave the band, and wish him all the best in his retirement. And they have hired Ricky Simpkins, Ronnie's brother. Ronnie plays bass with the band, but Ricky Simpkins is going to be on board with the Seldom Scene. And that'll be the new lineup they'll have. Look forward to hearing them coming up this year. Now, with all the talk of changes in bands and new bands being formed, a few episodes back when I had Tim Shelton on, I actually mentioned on there the desire to form a unit at some point. And today I want to sort of announce an initiative to form a band. And by that, I mean I'm actively looking for people to start this with. It is very open-ended at this point. When I first started having the idea to do something like this, I thought I had to have a particular thing in mind. I thought I had to have an idea of what the end product should be. And lately, I've come to the realization that no, that doesn't have to be the case. Whoever is interested and wants to do this with me will ultimately determine what it ends up being. And again, this is completely open to anybody that has the talent. That's the key ingredient, number one, is to be good. So if you play an instrument, singing obviously helps a lot. But if you're really just good at an instrument, shoot me a note, send me a video or something of yourself playing, and you will be considered. I'm serious about doing this. It may take a long time. I'm not on any sort of time schedule to get this done. And this in no way affects my commitment to playing with Sierra and playing the dates that I'm committed to playing this year in particular. This is something that I want to put together methodically and methodically introduce and really try to get off the ground in the future. So I want your help either way. If you're a great musician who is looking for an opportunity to start a band or start a unit, it could, again, this is so open-ended. It could be a trio. It could be a quartet. It could be quintet. It's very open-ended at this point. The main thing is it has to be good. But if you're that musician or that singer, shoot me an email at justin@justinmoses.com. If you're not, if you're just a listener to this show, if you have somebody in mind, if you have an idea of somebody that, hey, this person might be really great, send that to me. I'm very open right now to a suggestion. And again, this is something I'm wanting to do in the next several months. Also, write me at that address, justin@justinmoses.com, and let me know what your thoughts are on what the act should be, what it should be like. You can also tweet me at justinmoses2. You can write on my Facebook wall, Justin Moses Music, facebook.com/justinmosesmusic. Let me know your thoughts. Another thing I should say is that it's not just about talent either. That I did say that's the main thing, and it is in a certain regard, but personality is a huge factor in it too. We must be compatible if we're going to make music together. We must be able to work together on music, and also must be able to travel together if we ever intend to do any traveling, which that is my hope and goal. So there you have it. Now, on a much lighter note, I have mentioned before on this podcast my affinity for pro wrestling. And last night provided me a good opportunity to mix those two things, wrestling and bluegrass music. It was really pretty funny. I have to give a little bit of backstory to make this make any sense. So there's this wrestler. His name is Xavier Woods. And he's part of a group called The New Day. And they come out and they act over the top every week. Xavier started carrying a trombone to the ring and playing it during the matches. There was three of the guys and two of them would wrestle. And he'd stand out there and play the trombone. Well, last week a guy destroyed his trombone. And so this week, one of the announcers, John Bradshaw Layfield, says, you know, he's going on about how Xavier is, they're just sad. The group is sad because they've lost their trombone. But in the middle of this, he says, you think Earl Scruggs wouldn't be sad if he lost his banjo? And that made my night last night. So anyways, that's a little antidote for this week. I do want to, before I get into the interview, plug the upcoming dates I have with Sierra. On January the 28th, we'll be at City Winery in Nashville, Tennessee. January the 29th, we'll be at Eddie's Attic in Decatur, Georgia. That City Winery show, by the way, is the album release show. And all these upcoming shows are part of the Weighted Mind Tour. January the 30th, we'll be at the Clayton Center for the Arts in Maryville, Tennessee. That's out in East Tennessee, where very close to where I'm originally from. February the 2nd, we'll be at the Southern Cafe and Music Hall in Charlottesville, Virginia. February the 3rd, the Ram's Head in Annapolis, Maryland. February the 4th, Sellersville Theater in Sellersville, Pennsylvania. February the 5th, the Beacon Theater in Hopewell, Virginia. February the 6th, Altamont Theater in Asheville, North Carolina. And then February the 9th, we'll be in Lake Wells, Florida at the Lake Wells Art Center, both the 9th and the 10th. Then on the 11th, we'll be at the Lyric Theater in Stuart, Florida. And the 12th, the Ruby Diamond Auditorium in Tallahassee, Florida. That gets us through the first little section of those dates, and I will give the next round on the next episode. But in the meantime, go check out my website, justinmoses.com. You can see all the scheduled dates that we have right now there on into the future. Got some cool stuff coming up this year. We're playing Merlefest, Telluride, and it should be a really fun year. I do want to quickly plug the next couple of episodes that are coming up. The next one will be with Ronnie Bowman, and the one after that will be with Mac Wiseman, and I think those are two really great interviews that you're really going to not want to miss. I'm very proud of those two in particular. So now I'm going to get right into the part two of the interview I did with John Weisberger a few weeks back, and I really think you'll enjoy it. We get into a lot of good stuff, so here it goes. Well, did you get to meet and talk to Monroe much?
No, actually, yeah. Bill was one of the, I never did an interview with him. Yeah. I met him a few times just at shows.
Right.
I was at the, I think it was the last outdoor festival that he played, which was in Southeast Indiana, not long before he got sick.
Yeah,
and I met him then. I remember it was brutally hot. It must have been over 100 degrees, and he was suited up, buddy.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And I had spent a few years in the mid-80s, or the second half of the 80s, living in the Columbus, Ohio area,
mm-hmm.
And had done a few things around town with Tom Ewing, who then went on and joined the Bluegrass Boys. So that was my connection there. So I got to meet Bill and visit with him a little bit, but that was it. Most fun interview probably was Jimmy Martin.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And Tracy Todd, great DJ here in town, got me hooked up with that. And I think she kind of it was a very dicey thing because it was you know, during the season he wants to go out and play. And you can't hardly catch him. And then as soon as the season, once coon hunting season started up, you couldn't get him for anything.
Right. Yeah.
But Tracy managed to get me some time. I think I came down, it was during Spigma maybe, and went out to his place. And he a lot of great stories, obviously, and a lot of great musical philosophy
mm-hmm.
from him. He said, worst thing they ever do is call it bluegrass.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and that's one of those things that I think really is so characteristic of the older generations in this. It's starting to be less true because the music's getting old enough, but the guys who are around in the 50s and the 60s really look at, they're still... Most of them that I've talked to still think it was not a good thing for bluegrass to have kind of gotten separated from country.
From country, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mainstream, from a business point of view.
Right,
at least.
Right.
And, you know, and gosh, I was just talking to somebody who was talking about the need to use amplified instruments when they were out playing on these country package shows. Oh, no, I was, Del and I were talking about mm-hmm. this because... he was playing with Monroe. Every once in a while, I think they ask him, well, what kind of places did you play? Because there weren't any bluegrass festivals, you know? Right. And we're so used to thinking of festivals as
right,
the meat and potatoes of the bluegrass business.
Mm-hmm.
What'd they do? I asked Roland one time, where'd you play with Bill? He said, a lot of dives.
Yeah.
Which we don't think of uh-huh. Bill Monroe, but that's what they did. When Del was with him, he said they played a lot of country package shows. And mm-hmm. he said, well, a lot of people weren't listening to us because, you know, Monroe wasn't as big a star as George Jones or something like that was. And he said, the other thing, they couldn't hear us. You know? And so that obviously kind of played a role. But I remember, of course, when Sonny and Bobby plugged in, it's I believe that even with the way that mainstream country music is now, there is still, in some bigger picture, this is all still part of the same musical.
Well, yeah, world. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you talk to somebody that doesn't know anything about bluegrass, and I mean, they're going to think of it as just this country, in quotes, you know what I mean? Like, kind of music.
You know? Yeah, exactly. You know, and when you dig down behind the stars who are out front and you look at who's playing in these bands, there's a lot of bluegrass musicians playing
in country bands. Oh, in country bands, yeah, absolutely,
All over the place, and
they're like cousins that don't always get along, but you know they're because I mean I feel like today's country music and bluegrass is further apart in a lot of ways. Yeah. You know, like I don't relate to the modern, like, you know, new country, but country from, you know, 30, 40 years ago is a lot more similar, you know.
Well, and I think, too, you know, when I was doing my country music journalism, I really kind of learned a fair amount about the industry. And one thing that became really obvious to me is there's kind of an upper crust. Until fairly recently, it was the people who were selling lots of records, but hardly anybody sells lots of records anymore. But radio airplay, well, when we think of country radio, I know what I think. You know, I think of mainstream country radio like WSM FM here or some of the Sirius channels that are geared towards contemporary country. Mm-hmm. Well, what gets the big airplay is what gets the big attention, the big award winners and all that stuff. But there are thousands of country radio stations in the United States, and there's maybe 150 that report to the Billboard chart. So the chart reflects, and I mean, it's not a conspiracy to cover up. So I think that's where the big audience is.
Yeah.
But yet, there is, once you get past that, there are still thousands of radio stations that will play a broad variety of country music, not just today's hits, but catalog stuff that will have a bluegrass show or include some bluegrass stuff in there. When you get to country music venues, and there are thousands of them around the country, they're not all doing new country stuff.
When you
go see the Opry, you're going to see, hopefully, I mean, one of the things I love about the Opry is you see the very newest big guys are out there. They'll come and play the Opry, and then, you know, folks who've been playing there for 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
And bluegrass and swing and old-timey and every variety of country music is still represented on the Grand Ole Opry, as it kind of always has been. And that makes it very cool. And then you can kind of see the connections easier, you know.
All right. I got at least two more things want to get to. So IBM made board of directors,
yes.
And you were the chair.
I was. I joined the IBMA in 1992, I think, or maybe 1991. Before we got Union Springs going, Dwight McCall and our banjo player Randy Pollard and I all played for Vernon McIntyre Jr., son of Boat Whistle McIntyre, who played bass with Earl Taylor. Legendary, great bluegrass musician.
Yeah.
And we showcased at the World of Bluegrass in Owensboro in 1991, and that was my first exposure to the IBMA, which at that point was like 5-6 years old.
Yeah, it was pretty new.
And I joined the next year, it just seemed obvious to me that this music needs a trade association to help organize it, to help make it more business-like, and to look for opportunities to promote the brand of bluegrass. And again, just kind of because I had some abilities and some time, I started out in by the late 90s. I got involved in putting together seminars for the annual convention. And then was appointed to the board of directors in 2005, 2005, I guess it was 2006, and right when there was a big blow up about the Navy band and their performance on the award
show.
Oh
yeah, I remember that too. Yeah.
Well, so that was a baptism by fire because David Crow, who had just been appointed as reappointed as chairman of the board, resigned, and so Greg Cahill stepped into that position to take his place, and Stan Sadonik from the Boston Bluegrass Union became vice chair, and I had just been appointed to the executive committee, so that was the body that was kind of supposed to get everything back together. So it was quite an introduction. But I think I spent 11 years on the board, the last two as chair, and just recently retired, and I think it's a great organization. A few years ago, we had a big campaign to get people to buy lifetime memberships for $1,000, and I had the money, and I thought, well, this is a good investment, and I'm really happy to have done it. I think the organization has a real role to play and a real challenge because, and this has kind of been my hobby horse for the last little while. As a songwriter, one of the people that I write with the most is Jeremy Garrett from the infamous String Dusters. And the infamous String Dusters have done a lot of things that we've written together. Mm-hmm. And they also, their big hit still was Fork in the Road, which Chris Jones wrote, and which Jeremy learned when he was in the band with us. And so that kind of gave the Night Drivers in general, and me in particular, a little bit of a foot in the door in a kind of jam grass world. Been able to go out and play. We played Big Sky, Big Grass. We played Grand Targhee, some of these other festivals that are in more of that kind of direction. And then I've been out some with the Dusters to watch their shows and their audiences and talk to their management and, you know, all our team guys. And between that and some other things, it's become clear to me there's a whole other bluegrass industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, if you want to talk just financially, it's bigger.
Exactly.
In the mainstream bluegrass industry. And I believe that in general, the leadership in the IBMA and the rank and file, too, understand that we need to have these folks kind of... have a bigger umbrella that includes these folks. So there's no, if you say, in general terms, everybody's agreed on that. But when it kind of comes down to the specifics, well, how do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes a little more challenging. But I think that's really critical because I know, and I mean, the funny thing is, I'm not a Newgrass guy in terms of what I like to listen to. Mm-hmm. I'm about as traditional as you get. I mostly listen to Flat and Scruggs radio shows. You know, I mean, I listen to a lot of stuff for doing the radio thing, and I, you know, I'm listening to what I do to try and figure out how I can make it better, but just for my own listening, I like a lot of different kinds of music, but at the end of the day, it's always bluegrass, just straight ahead, you know, bluegrass is what I really, really love. But I know when I go out and play at the bread and butter bluegrass festivals on this side of the Mississippi or of the Rockies, the audiences are mostly really old. And that's not good.
Not for the future, yeah.
You're right, you know. But when you go out into these other kinds of venues, the audiences are mostly young. Mm-hmm. Not only young, it's not a strict generational thing, and I always want to warn people off because, well, look, here's Sam Bush. Now, generationally, you know, he's one age, but stylistically something else. And then you've got plenty of young musicians. You go to IBMA or to Spigma or a lot of other places, and there are plenty of young musicians who are playing in traditional style.
Right.
You've got a band like Flat Lonesome, you know, great band. Young, very young, but straight ahead
very
kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But still, so I'm really more concerned about the audiences.
Right.
You know, because it's hard for a music to stay vital if a significant core of people can't do it for a living. And that means you have to have an audience that's renewing. And that means you have to have younger people. And I will say, I believe, well, because I've seen it with my own eyes, that there is some portion of that Jamgrass audience that when they hear, when the String Dusters do Love Gone Cold, old Johnny Bond song, Red Allen, and, you know, all these folks have done, want to know more about that song.
Yeah.
And want to find other recordings of it. And I think that this is, we're sort of seeing really the payoff of something that started to change in the years after Jerry Garcia passed away, because all those Grateful Dead fans were looking for something else. And some portion of them knew how much he liked bluegrass and how much he did bluegrass and bluegrassy kinds of stuff. And so they kind of grabbed him. I remember we had a weekly gig in the Cincinnati area that you could see over the course of about 2 years, these folks coming in. And that's, you know, but young audiences, man, you got to get them. And then some of those audiences, some of those people will hear Junior Sisk or Flat Lonesome or more traditional oriented artists and dig it.
Yeah.
And that'll be part of their listening. And so I think that the way to help preserve every kind of bluegrass, including the most traditional, is to really take this kind of broad outlook.
Well, the prime example to me is Del McCurry, because he successfully kind of gotten in a position to play some of these, you know, festivals and things. And he's, I mean, he's so on the traditional side. I mean, like the band, they come up with, you know, I love their arrangements because they do things that are more progressive in certain sense. But I mean, if you just listen to that band, that's a traditional bluegrass band if there ever was one, you know. But why wouldn't the broader bluegrass community, or the I don't know how to put it really, but the bluegrass community that tends to be narrower, why wouldn't they want to have that same audience for as many people as possible? Under the umbrella of calling it bluegrass.
It's risky to speculate about.
Of course, people don't understand.
But I will. I mean, I think it's some of it is, and this is a really touchy subject. And I will say, you know, having sat on the board of the IBMA, and kind of, which sort of makes you kind of look at what is this industry and what's this community.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being impressed, and I wrote a piece about this a while ago. 10 years ago, Mitch Jane, the guy that played bass with the Dillards, is credited with saying, "Bluegrass doesn't make friends; it doesn't make fans; it makes converts." And I've heard that as long as I've been around bluegrass. And I got to thinking, and I thought, you know, that's kind of a mixed bag.
It is totally, yeah.
But it speaks to that sense of people. Some people have a very passionate identification with this that goes beyond simply liking a kind of music. And that's where, and there's definitely, there's some kind of cultural lifestyle clashes that occur there when you mix these different audiences.
Yeah, well, I think that's a problem a lot of festivals, for instance, have, because I know of one in particular that has really tried to keep the more traditional-based audience and bring in the other. Yeah. And then there's sometimes, like you're saying, there's a, they don't always get along as well as they should or could.
And you know, and it manifests itself even in some very benign sort of things like dancing,
right? Exactly.
You know,
that's it.
Even if I have seen festivals where even where the dancers are off on the side and not in anybody's view, just the fact that they were there, you know, with their hula hoops bothered some people. And so that's, that's very short-sighted, I think.
It is, and it's difficult to, at some point, you know, if, at some point, if it's going to progress and continue on like we're talking about and get bigger, you know, it's just got to sort of move beyond those concerns a little bit, you know, in some way or another, because I think we know there's more people to be had in the other side of it, you know.
Well, exactly, and I think, you know,
or at least I think.
I think so, and I think the music is the healthiest when you have some fans who are, that's all they want to listen to. Mm-hmm. That's all they're into. And that's great. And you need that.
Nothing wrong with it, yeah.
Music that is, a musical style that is, an industry that are healthy also have a lot of people for whom that's part of what they listen to.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
My wife has 10 presets on her satellite radio mm-hmm. receiver, and she listens to some bluegrass, she listens to, you know, the 80s channel, and she's got, and that's what most people, that's why you have preset buttons.
Yeah.
You have more than one preset.
Yeah.
Because people like to flip around and listen to different things in different moods and different circumstances. For bluegrass really to be healthy and survive and thrive, in addition to the core of fans who are just like really passionate about it, you also need to have as many people as possible for whom, oh yeah, I like those guys. That's bluegrass. Okay, yeah. So I'm open to hearing somebody else that's in that vein,
right?
But maybe I'm not going to like them, or uh-huh. I'm going to like it every once in a while. That's what somebody like Allison does,
right?
Or Ricky, uh-huh. you know. They bring casual listeners to it.
Well, that's a discussion that I had the other day, or it was a part of this, you know, discussion of Sirius kind of preempting bluegrass for a yeah. few days. And I said to somebody, well, I think some of these listeners, it's probably a different channel in the sense that I don't know that there's as many casual listeners to this channel as a lot of them. And that speaks back to, being so hardcore into it. Well, maybe it might do some good to have a few days to like turn it to something else for, you know what I'm saying? Give something uh-huh. else a little bit of a chance. You know, I have, like you're talking about presets set too, uh-huh. and I flip around, you know, yeah. I hear different things, and I listen to talk radio, I listen to whatever, you know, it's, there's a lot of good things out in the world to take in, you know.
Yeah, there are, and it helps. You know, it helps. I think those things. You know, Monroe listened to a lot of different kinds of stuff. He didn't like yeah. to talk about it much, but uh-huh. He listened to a lot of different things. Earl, obviously, you know, mm-hmm. made a point of it.
Yeah.
And I don't think, you know, there's room for so many different things. There's room for, and I tend to argue as much as I need, as I think it's good to be open and to all these different things. I don't think you have to be. I just read a piece on some old time bands No Depression, I think, and the guy was saying, well, why are people playing the same old tunes over again? That's not good. And I thought, well, there's a reason those tunes are still around.
Absolutely.
And you know, if you look at a guy like, and I think different kinds of music maybe have sort of different sort of values embedded in them, not like moral values necessarily, but kind of musical values. So mm-hmm. in jazz or rock and roll, innovation. It's like, that's a big thing. If you do the same kind of thing for three or four records, you're getting stale, you're in a rut, you need to, you know. And so when, you know, you hear about a band reinventing itself all the time, right? They've reinvented, they've opened up this whole new territory, musical territory. And that's seen as a good thing in and of itself, to be new and different and not do what you've been doing. But in the country and bluegrass world, you know, I mean, Ralph Stanley, it's interesting, he progressed by going backwards. If you listen to Stanley Brothers and then listen to Ralph, he definitely moved in this kind of more old-timey mm-hmm. sort of direction. And then he's basically done the same thing for 50 years. And it's great.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't want, I mean, why would you want him to do anything else? If he doesn't want to do anything else, he shouldn't have to do anything else.
Right, right.
But yet at the same time, you know, so people say, well, music has to evolve. I don't think that's... It does in the biggest sense, but that doesn't mean every artist has to.
No, no.
It means you want this big spectrum of all mm-hmm. these different styles and things. And I think that listening to other kinds of music brings good influences in that then kind of spread as far as they're going to spread in the mm-hmm. in the general bluegrass world. And I've noticed the same thing with songwriting. One of the things I like about writing bluegrass songs is you can write a verse and a chorus song if you go, when you go to a writing room, a writing appointment here on Music Row, you write a couple of verses and chorus, and it's time to write the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just assumed that there's going to be a bridge.
That's the way it is. Yeah,
that's the right way it is. Well, more bluegrass songs now have bridges in them than used to, but you can still write a bluegrass song that doesn't have a bridge and nobody will think twice about it. Mm-hmm. You don't even need to have a chorus. You can have, you know, what I call a refrain, right? Just a little repeating thing at the end of each. And I love that. And why would you want it to be any different? But still, I love hearing, as much as I love hearing straight ahead stuff, I also love hearing some new song where you can hear that the songwriters have been listening to other kinds of stuff as well.
All right. You know? Well, I know you got to get off to Dale's show, right?
Yeah.
But tell us about, what's the name of the latest Chris Jones record?
The latest Chris Jones record is called Runaway Tonight.
Uh-huh. And the Night Drivers, I mean, you know, the band.
Chris Jones and the Night Drivers. Well, you know, it's been exciting. We've had the same guys in the band for a long time.
Yeah, yeah, and that's a great thing, too. It's also pretty rare in bluegrass, but it's nice to have to establish
the band. Well, you know how you learn how other people play and sing, and when you really work with the same bunch of folks for a long time, you really get to dig into each other's stuff, and you the music becomes richer, you know. I think we've hit a pretty good groove. This is our first record for Mountain Home. We signed with them, and it's great working in their studio, and we knocked this one out pretty quick, and it was a real pleasure to make. And we had the first single was just done better than anybody expected. Chris and I wrote that. It's a song called Lori. Mm-hmm. And we wrote, it's funny how it, kind of inspiration works. Chris and I, last summer or the summer before, when we were talking about Mountain Home, we drove down there to have a meeting with him and I, and we're looking around for something to listen to in the van, and I found this old Uncle Dave Macon CD. And I went through a big Uncle Dave period 30 years ago. I learned all his songs. I just loved him. We share a birthday. He's got the same birthday that I do. So that. And but I hadn't listened in years, 20 years probably, since I listened to Uncle Dave Macon. So I threw it in. One of the things that we noticed was, some of these songs, there's a verse and a chorus, and then there's some instrumental interlude that's the same every time, but it's not connected musically.
Right.
It's just some other lick that's really cool. Right. And we thought, well, that would be fun. And so that was kind of the idea for this song, such as it was. And it wound up being sort of a kind of old-timey flavored thing. And when we were in the studio, Mountain Home folks were in. I said, boy, that's really catchy. That's catchy. And it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it went just about straight to number one. It's been number one for a good chunk of this fall. So that's been really, really exciting to have that. And it's a good record. Chris and I wrote three songs together on that. And then we also cut a song I wrote with Jeremy Garrett that the String Dusters are doing. So that's very rare. It's rare these days for more than one artist to do a song, a new song. But we kind of got lucky there. But Jeremy and I kind of wrote it with Chris's voice in mind. So
gotcha.
It's nice to have that done.
Well, also tell us about your two solo records.
Oh, yeah. Well,
both of them have kind of core band, right?
Yes.
Same band, too.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Particularly the second one. The first one was part of my campaign to get people to stop thinking of me as a as a writer.
Gotcha.
And think of me as a musician and songwriter. And but I felt like I needed to make a record. And I had all these. By that point, I was really starting to write a lot of songs, and I had these songs that hadn't been demoed, and I thought, well, I could make records good enough to be a record, but then they also kind of work as demos and, you know, just kind of an introduction generally. And I had reviewed maybe 5 or 6 years before that a record that John Pinnell had made, and it was all songs that he had written and co-written, and he played on about all of them, but he didn't sing any of them. He had Harley. He wrote a couple. He wrote with Harley, so Harley sang him. There's a killer version of "Carry Me Across the Mountain" mm-hmm. on that CD that I think Jeff White sings. He was one of the three writers on that, yeah. And you know, so it was a songwriter's album,
right?
And I thought, that's, I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
That I can do, because, you know, I was thinking, well, if I'm going to make a record, I'm not a lead singer. What am I going to do? And so that turned out to be the answer. And so the core band on half of that album was the Lonesome Heirs, with me and Ned Lubarecki, who plays with me, Chris Jones and Night Drivers, and Jesse Brock, who was an original Night Driver,
mm-hmm.
and Jeremy Garrett from the infamous String Dusters, who had been a Night Driver.
Yep.
And had also, it turned out, I didn't know this until for a few years, but Jesse had actually, Jeremy and his dad had a band called the Grasshoppers out in mm-hmm. Idaho, and Jesse Brock had actually gone out and spent like a winter playing gigs with them at a ski resort up there. So they knew each other. And then Andy Falco, who's now with the String Dusters, but actually at the time that the record was made, had not yet joined the String Dusters. He was right. still playing with Alicia Nugent.
Yep.
And so that was the band on about half of it. And then I had Chris come in and play a few things. I had Megan McCormick come and play guitar on a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
I had Ron Block come and play banjo on one and guitar on one. In fact, one of the things, you've produced your own stuff, but have you been involved in producing other records?
No, it's something I'd love to do, because I have I'm halfway, let's say, involved in producing Sierra's brother's record right now.
Right.
And just kind of like casually helping him with it. And I wouldn't really call myself the producer, but I love that sort of thing. I feel like I have a little bit to contribute there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. So that's something I'm interested in doing more of. But
so one of the cool things about it, at least for these records, because the idea was, and for that record in particular, was different combinations of people. Like,
yeah.
Who would you really like to hear playing together?
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, so Megan McCormick, fabulous guitar player. So I had her and Ron play on this one ballad. It was just two guitars, bass, and dobro. Mike Witcher played dobro,
mm-hmm.
and Megan and Ron played the two guitars. And Ron had never heard her, had never heard her before. So that was really cool to introduce them. And then the other cut where he played banjo, I had Jenny Lynn Gardner,
mm-hmm.
who was at that point pretty new to town. She'd only right. been here for a year and a half or so. And that was really cool to like put those folks together. I had Dave Peterson, he sang two songs on the album, and I got Robert Gately, who's a fabulous singer, great songwriter, mm-hmm. great musician. No, not nearly as well known as he ought to be, but man, he came in and he killed it with Peterson. So yeah. Putting those combinations together was a whole lot of fun. And it included some songs that I'd written back in the 90s. And then a bunch of co-writes with Jeremy and with Justin Carbone, who used to play guitar with Special Consensus,
mm-hmm.
and Mark Simos,
right.
great songwriter up in Boston. He
absolutely
as a song. There have been some people that, I think with any songwriter, there's some people that you really click with as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark was one that he and I have written a lot of, probably 25, 30 songs together.
Yeah.
A really important early influence on me as a songwriter. Because I didn't start writing until I moved here, basically. I wrote a few things back in the 90s, but
mm-hmm.
but I really took off when I wrote here. So there are three songs, I think, that he and I wrote. And a couple of Jeremy Garrett and I wrote. He's the another main songwriting partner. Tim Stafford's another. So I did that record and was really, really happy with the way it came out. We cut it at Ben Surratt's studio. Ben's mm-hmm. a great engineer. And then back in 2014... It's still last year for now. By the time this comes out, it'll be the year before last.
Uh-huh.
Dan Keene and I put a little venture together called Wise Kings, and decided wanted to make a record again that would highlight the songwriting, original songs, and we thought, well, it would be nice to also make it a benefit for the IBMA.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think one of the things, you know, the Country Music Hall of Fame for a while has had this All for the Hall program going.
Right.
And when it started out, it was like, do a show and donate the proceeds. Whatever kind of show, whenever, where, it's all, whatever you want to do, however, what makes sense for you. But the idea is take one show dedicated to the hall. And the idea has kind of changed a little bit for the Country Music Hall of Fame since then, but I thought that was a really good idea, and I thought it was something that could be applicable in the bluegrass world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do a show, donate the proceeds, make a record, make a donation to the IBMA, do something. Sure. so that you know, rather than try and organize one big spectacular thing that makes a bunch of money, to have a lot of little folks kind mm-hmm. of buying in. And so there the idea was just kind of the next step from the first album, and that was to write songs with a bunch of different people, have them come in and sing the songs that we'd mm-hmm. written, and then back it up with the Lonesome Airs, me and
sure.
Jesse and Andy and Jeremy and Ned. And so that's what we did. And Sierra, that was actually the first song that Sierra Hull and I ever wrote.
Uh-huh.
It got put on that record. She came in and killed it. And I just had a really nice assortment of folks. And some Jeremy, who I've written a lot with, Tom Utz, who you've had on the podcast.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. He and Kim Ritchie and I had written a song together, so we cut that. Kim actually recorded her vocal out in Colorado.
All right.
And Tom did his in his studio. And then the Gibson Brothers, we had a song that I wrote with those guys. Had Pam Tillis on mm-hmm. that, and that's led to an interesting collaboration that you've been a little part of. Pam's vocal was about the very last thing that we put on the record, and she cut her vocal at Eric Chiskoviak's studio.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting experience for me to watch somebody who's that good a singer. I mean, and there are many great singers in bluegrass. And I have many great singers on the album. Dalen Bradley sang on the album. Mm-hmm. Claire Lynch sang on the album. Killer Stuff Sierra. Sean Camp, Male Vocalist of the Year. Mm-hmm. Jim Lauderdale. I'm really happy with the way the record came out. But Pam Tillis, her singing has sold millions of records.
Mm-hmm.
Millions. It's touched millions of people.
Right.
And watching somebody at that level work in the studio was just really, really interesting. I kind of saw it. It's the same sort of thing I saw with Ron Block when he worked on his break on the first album that I did. Started out with kind of like it was a sort of banjo, kind of played the melody, and he worked on it for 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes, and by the end it was a Ron Block break,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you can see his personality kind of seeping into it
right.
With every pass. And it was the same deal with Pam, you know, she'd sing it through, and then she'd come back through again, and all of a sudden here's this move that's a Pam Tillis move, you know, mm-hmm. and then somewhere else, and I think she really enjoyed the experience, and she'd been looking for ways to maybe do some more acoustic rootsy kind of stuff, and
right.
so over the last year we've been doing some writing together and played Music City Roots. You were part of the band there. It was great to. I think that was the first. Was that the first time we got to play together?
I believe it is. Yeah. I believe it is.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was fun.
Well, except for the 1861 project stuff
right.
we played together. Yeah,
yeah. Uh-huh. in the studio,
uh-huh.
I guess, yeah. And. Well, we've done a couple.
We
of demos
did, yeah, gig.
As well. Yeah, yeah. But anyway, so she was on that record, and that record was such a pleasure to make, and it was really cool. I don't, you know, everybody's busy, but this Lonesome Airs thing actually seems to have some kind of little legs to it. That combination mm-hmm. of guys, and I love it because it kind of puts you know, Jeremy and Andy are so well known for jamming out and right. you know, playing, but they can play really great straight ahead bluegrass. And then you got mm-hmm. a guy like Jesse Brock, who's, you know, a master of his kind of traditional mandolin, has put him, the songs we were doing, some were, you know, edgier, kind of pushed him out of his comfort zone a little right. bit. And, mm-hmm. and of course, Ned, to me, is one of the most underrated banjo players around. He can mm-hmm. do, he can play killer straight ahead driving bluegrass. He can play all this kind of crazy out there stuff and everything in between. So, and we all really enjoyed working together. We cut, we tracked the album. We did all the instrumental tracks in 2 days, and they were not long days either. We just kind of went in and bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
And it sounds really good. So I was pleased with that. And the, you know, the opportunity to write and record with all those great, great folks was something that was really, really special.
Do you have you kept track of how many songs, first of all, you've written in general or co-written, and then how many cuts you have?
I'm closing in on about 500 songs uh-huh. written, and most of that really in the last 4 years or so was when I really, really got into it. I went through a great program here in Nashville called Leadership Music in 2011, and to one of my classmates, was a guy named Rusty Gaston, who has a publishing company called This Music, and they have a ton of contemporary country hits. And I went to see him a couple of years ago to just kind of get his advice on a few things. And he said, one thing to keep in mind is that when you're trying to get a cut here on Music Row, you're competing with people who are writing a song a day, mm. every day.
Oh, yeah.
Week in, week out. And I thought, well, I can't, man, I got too much. I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I could try to write 100 songs in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't quite make it, but that really kind of upped my game and started me, just the sheer product. It's like practicing.
Yeah.
You know, just the sheer doing it, the more you do it, the better you get at it. And mm-hmm. so I really kind of bore down on that. I've had, including my records and the Chris Jones records and all that, I probably have around 130 songs recorded now, or 130 yeah. recordings of songs. Some songs have been recorded a couple of times. The first big hit that I had was a song called Losing Again that the Chapmans recorded back almost 15 years ago.
I remember that, yeah.
And that one, that's kind of because I still, it turns out people are still recording that,
mm-hmm.
basically. There's a dozen or so recordings of that out there, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, around 130, something like that. It's been, there are a lot of people making records,
mm-hmm.
and they need songs.
Yeah.
And there are some great songwriters working, and I've been lucky to write with some of them. So,
yeah. Well, do you have anything? Did we leave anything out?
I don't think so.
Right. yeah. Anything else you gotta you want to plug? Your website, Twitter, Facebook?
Well, my website, my firm resolve is to get my website up and running by the uh-huh. end of the year. So yeah. I think it's as safe as just johnweisberger.com.
All right.
And I'm on Twitter at John Weisberger. I'm on Facebook, John Weisberger, and Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, well, as you know, one of the really big changes in the music industry. See, I started really paying attention to the industry as an industry in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, and that, so that was kind of the tail end of the music industry as it had been for 30 or 40 years or more. And then by the time I really, when I moved to Nashville to make a living in it, it was, the change was just, you know, Napster had been around for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
There were changes in so many things, you know, so I've had this kind of interesting vantage point of really seeing how it worked in the old way and then watching the new way. And one of the obvious things to me about the music business these days is that there are so many things that you have to do and have to take into account that you didn't used to, you know, and they're social media
being yeah.
an obvious example, you know, and that's really, it's challenging because it means taking time away from your music. And so that's kind of the drag. But on the, but the good, the upside is that you build relationships with fans that are ongoing and durable,
uh-huh.
you know, and that, and, again, watching this with some of the more cutting edge folks, I think records say, I don't think, and I hate it because I love records. And I read, I just read a great piece, by a guy named David Newhoff, who said, you know, records are the most important kind of music. And he, I thought he really, he, you know, we associate music with different events and periods in our life and people and things and all that. And it's almost always recorded music.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the live concert experience is great for a lot of people. That's what it's all about. Like the String Dusters don't sell a lot of records, but they sell a lot of tickets.
Yeah.
And their fans are passionate about them, and they will, and they'll swap board recordings,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they will buy any kind of merch, and they will, and they are like really big for premium experiences, getting to meet the band, yeah. or get, you know, getting to do special or access to special stuff, but not records. No, I think that's unfortunate, but I think that's the way things are going. And so to survive as a musician, you have to develop a relationship with fans mm-hmm. who are then motivated to not just follow your music, but, you know, kind of be more supportive.
Right, right. And, actually want to own something that you did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. It's, I was thinking about that. I just listened to your podcast where you talked about Beyond Measure, and you
right.
wound up talking about, you call it Beyond Measure the EP because you're thinking about maybe, mm-hmm. maybe using that title for another record. Or one of the things I've done over the last few years is spend some time kind of mentoring younger musicians and artists. And one of the things that I've kind of come to think of, and this is why I think you made a good move putting this EP out, is it's like the easiest thing is to make a record. You know, all you need is some songs and right. some ideas, and yeah. you uh-huh. can go record it and not even spend very much money. And so if you get it, if you get into a studio and record some stuff, you have every reason to put it out.
Yeah.
You know, because, and what happens is a lot of times a band will, obviously a younger band will make a record and they'll say, man, it would be great if we could get on a label,
mm-hmm.
get a label to put this out. And so they shop it around. And they shop it around and they shop it around, shop it around. And months can go by.
Mm-hmm.
And then nothing happens. So they wind up putting it out themselves. Only by then they're sick of it.
You know? Yeah.
And especially with a younger band that's developing, it's not even a very good representation of where they are now musically.
Sure, you know? Yeah, because it's been so long.
So my advice, if you got to shop a record around, give yourself like a month. And if yeah. you don't have a pretty firm indication of interest, go ahead and put it out yourself. And then if somebody gets interested, you make them another record.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And that's different. That's very different than it used to be.
Yeah.
So,
and the whole social media. I think I could do a whole podcast on the challenges of trying to stay on top of all of that and think about what you need to do to kind of promote this record or new yeah. project at the same time as you've got to do. You know, you've got to do everything else that you've got to do. You got to go work. You got to go play. You know, session and do all this stuff and come back and still think about that, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. No, it's huge, and I think, I mean, it's definitely different. And honestly, I think in many ways it's worse. It's worse because it's a, you know, the I remember reading an interview with Dell years ago, and I made it my email signature for years. It was an interview with the New York Times, and he was talking about when he was, because, you know, he spent 20 years playing music on the side,
right.
and driving a truck.
Mm-hmm.
And he said those days when I had a day job, he said my music suffered because I couldn't put as much time into it as I wanted to.
Right.
And that's if you, there's only so many hours in a day,
mm-hmm.
and the more time that you have to spend promoting what you do, and social media is kind of the great equalizer because you can use it; it's free,
yeah, right,
you know,
right.
at least at a basic level.
Yeah,
you know,
there's
but
another conversation.
It takes,
about...
it takes energy and attention, and you have to integrate it into what all that you're doing, and that's time that's taken away from music. And the proponents, you know, there's a lot of folks who like to beat the drum for, you know, these new music models and all that, and I'm hopeful, in a wishful sort of way, that in the long, because their argument is the upside of that is that you're retaining, you're not, nobody else is making money off of all what you do. You know, you're getting the revenues coming directly to you. Hopefully someday that will really be true enough to make a difference. But right now I don't, it's very speculative that there's a really clear connection between all the additional energy that you have to put into non-musical endeavors
as
a payoff. Well,
works.
Yeah.
Well, you've been generous with your time, and I appreciate you doing this, taking the time to do it, and hope to have you back someday willing. And
always a pleasure. Yeah. I've enjoyed getting to know your music and you over the last year, 2 years, couple years. And
absolutely, same here.
Looking forward to it. Had a great time doing this.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Good deal, man.
Appreciate it. There you have it. That's part two of my interview with John Weisberger. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, don't forget to tune in next time. I have Ronnie Bowman coming up, and then after that, Mike Wiseman. A couple of great interviews that you're not going to want to miss. Hey, I thank you for tuning into the show, and I hope you really enjoyed it and that you'll come back for more. If you're just tuning in to this episode, be sure to check out the archive on soundcloud.com/CosmosisPodcast or my website, justinmoses.com. Or the easiest thing to do would be to subscribe on iTunes and just download all the old shows, and every new episode will show up automatically in the device of your choosing. So I would recommend highly subscribing on iTunes. And if you like the show, if you think it's good, review it and rate it on iTunes. And I hope you'll tune in next time. Thanks a lot, folks.